Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
And as Chris mentioned, Clinton, nice enough to fill in for Mace today, and we're loaded. The story with the Confederate flag broke right before we came on the air. It's now out completely.
Update.
Drivers, fans, what's your update?
Ryan McGee of Marty McGee will be joining us at 5:15 on this program today.
Perfect. All right,
doing a little producing on the side myself.
If you've never heard Marty and McGee, which is a show that ESPN Radio runs on the weekends, those guys are all over NASCAR. Those are the first two guys I thought of when this story broke. It would be great to get today. So Marty McGee going to join us coming up in a little more than an hour. We've got Fast Track at 5:30. Clinton, this is a story that I'm going to admit up front. I normally am pretty good at staking out a position and arguing whatever that position is. I don't know the right answer to this one, and I want to see if we can talk it out and maybe come to a consensus. It's an incredibly difficult decision. Yep. The NBA announced today that they're expected to ask anyone, it wasn't really announced, it was reported, that they're expected to ask anyone who wants to be part of the Orlando campus to submit a medical history to a panel of physicians who would review their risk of serious illness during COVID-19. This on the heels of Adam Silver mentioning on TNT the other night that he's walked it back since, but he may consider older people, people over the age of 60, to not be a part of the campus because his medical experts are telling him that that is the most dangerous age for people to catch COVID and, God forbid, get it as a very serious and perhaps terminal illness. So we've got this issue now where Adam and the people who run the NBA and the teams need to decide. They've got the medical people telling them anybody over the age of 60 is the most dangerous risk for COVID-19. And you've got these pillars of NBA lore. The best coach in the league is Greg Popovich. He's got 5 rings. He's 71. Mike D'Antoni, who runs the system that make the Rockets the Rockets. The Rockets don't have a center anymore because they're running D'Antoni's crazy open court system, is 68. Lionel Hollins, who's a key assistant on the Lakers. The Lakers have put together this staff that has old and young and Frank Vogel's in the middle, and it just works perfectly. And it's led him to the best record in the West. Lionel Hollins is 66. Alvin Gentry, the head coach of the Pelicans, is 65. I don't know what the right answer is here, Clinton. I don't know if I'm Adam Silver, if the medical people are telling me, don't put anybody over the age of 60 in there. If I make that a hard rule, I don't know if I leave it up to the individuals. If I go to Greg Popovich and say, look, here are the risks. You would need to sign a waiver, but it's up to you. What's the right way to handle this?
This is really tricky. And I'm glad you broke this down in terms of more than just head coaches, Ireland, because I think people look at them often and don't think about all the other guys that are on benches. This will go deeper into teams than folks realize. Here's the thing, though. The health risks are understandable. That's obviously a fair warning. But I think the NBA might have a bit of an out in dodging this, in that the competitive balance is kind of drastically changed. You know, like, I don't need the ageism sort of fundamental issue is kind of an aside to, well, what are these teams going to look like? You know what I'm saying? Like, are you changing the product on the court by not allowing guys to be a part of their teams in the way that they need to be, particularly because you're on this sprint run? You know, I think if you're going to come up with a good enough reason that the people are going to sell, you're going to say, well, it's affecting the product too much, and it's really just a recommendation. You know, that's the only way I can see them finding a way around this, because otherwise it sort of feels like, yo, dog, we've all been sitting in our houses for 3 months. You know what I'm saying? Like, why should NBA coaches be getting to go if they're the ones that are going to be at risk? Like, it's very back and forth, but I think the argument you're going to make to sell PR-wise is that we could not just have that many head coaches gone. you know, forget about ageism. It just wasn't going to work, you know, and I don't know if that's the right thing to do from a health standpoint, but it really sucks. This is one of those like actual bummers, you know, because you don't want to have to make a decision in that scenario. And you don't want somebody to get sick. Could be a disaster. I'm not looking forward to this discussion, though.
Right. And it's, well, I'll give you one example. Here's the good news. The Lakers have a unique relationship with UCLA Health. UCLA Health is the title sponsor of the Lakers' entire practice facility. And they have access to every doctor in the UCLA Health Network. So they're going to be able to make an extremely educated decision here. I've gotten to know some of these doctors, and these guys are just, I mean, the minute you hear them talk, you realize, okay, we have the best medical information we have. So for example, if the NBA did leave it up to the individual coaches whether or not they could go onto the campus, and a coach did want to go onto the campus, he could say, all right, he has at his disposal some really smart medical people that they could tell him, here's how much of a risk you're taking. So it would be a very educated decision. But that doesn't make Adam Silver's job any easier.
Right.
Adam might have to say, look, we went into this from the beginning, and he has said this consistently from the start. We're not putting anybody unnecessarily at risk. We are going to listen to our medical people. And if his medical people tell him, look, no one over a certain age goes onto the campus, I think he has to listen to him. That's it. That's the one thing he said he's always going to do. But you're right. It's such a hard decision because it does affect competitive balance. And it is, you could make a case that it's ageism, but it's life and death here. We're talking about, these are unprecedented circumstances with this COVID-19. We've never been through anything like this.
I would argue, though, in hearing you say what you're saying about what Adam said, is that he said they're not going to unnecessarily put somebody at risk. There's an outside argument. This is necessary. Like, they're the coaches, you know, and in basketball, more so than really any other sport, your connectivity and your intimacy with the game as it happens is vital, you know, and
yeah, that's indisputable.
You might be able to get around what we consider necessity. You know, I realize they're not playing the game. I realize they're not even the health officials, but like, I can't imagine a situation in which you kneecap a team with their leadership and then you feel that you've created, this is already a goofed up enough season as it is, you know, and what people think from the asterisk standpoint regarding the playoffs is going to be there. If you further cut it down, I don't know, man. It's just, it's really messing with the product. And I like the idea of the coaches being able to opt in and make their choices, but I don't know that I would sign off on that. That's above my pay grade, as we like to say, you know, but I do think that the definition of necessity here is important. And I would argue that coaches are necessary. You know, I just don't really know how else to say that. It's a different game if that many people, particularly if it's affected in different ways in different teams, are just gone. You know, it's a serious quagmire, and I do not envy Adam Silver right now.
Yeah, it's going to be, and this is one of the reasons why I mentioned to you the other day that whenever I talk to somebody from the NBA, they tell me, be cautious as you're reporting on the campus, as you're projecting out what's going to happen in Orlando. It's fine if you report what our plan is. We are planning ahead, but everything could change on a moment's notice. That there is not, I can tell you for a fact that at the NBA offices, nobody thinks this is 100% what's going to happen. They know that COVID could change all of it. And if there is a resurgence of it, or if somebody, you know, it also, you know, asks the question, and this is, Clinton, to me, fascinating. And this is more in the NFL than anything else. What happens if an entire position, like I'll use the NFL for an example.
Uh-huh.
The quarterback room in the NFL is normally three quarterbacks, the quarterback coach, and the offensive coordinator, and they're all working on a game plan, and they're all right, working on an offense. So what happens if one person in that room gets COVID? You got to quarantine the other guys. And what happens if it happens the day before a game? Bruce Arians has already admitted this, and I've been arguing this for 2 months, Clinton. that you might need to have an emergency, in case of emergency, break glass quarterback who lives and exists outside the quarterback's room. I would compare it to this is the reason they don't let airline pilots who are flying on the same flight in the same cockpit eat meals together on the same day they're flying. Because if somebody gets bad food, they don't want the whole cockpit going down. They want one guy to get sick and the other guy's being able to fly the plane. Do you need to plan that much ahead? Do you need to say, okay, we're going to have for positions that you can't play a game without a quarterback?
Yeah.
Do you need to plan ahead that way?
So this is twice now that DC has come up randomly, but for those of you who don't know, I'm from Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States of America, where we have a term for this. It's called the designated survivor. Hold that on TV show about it, because it's a thing that we do in government. When they, when the president addresses Congress.
Yeah, the West Wing was my favorite show for years, and they said to President Bartlet, to Martin Sheen, remind the president he needs to pick a guy.
Yeah.
And somebody said, what does that mean? And that's what you're talking about. Pick a guy who doesn't go to the State of the Union, who stays outside of that structure in case something happened. Wasn't that the whole basis of the Kiefer Sutherland show?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you something else. We're getting way into the weeds here, but like, that's a big fun parlor game at the bars in D.C. Who's going to be the designated survivor tonight? These are the kind of things that people joke about in the political towns. But anyway, yes, I think this is an absolutely good idea. I actually think that it would be foolish on a lot of levels not to at least have a plan. I don't know that you're... Is it going to be the starter? I don't know. But is it going to be somebody who you think can play? Absolutely. I mean, you're way ahead on this one, Ireland. This is smart. I hadn't even thought of this. But this is brilliant on a lot of levels because...
Okay, let me ask you this. Let me stretch it out. Yep. Do you need a whole taxi squad of designated survivors? In other words, one quarterback, 11? One running back, one lineman.
Ugh.
What? No, because think about it. If your offensive line, if the whole room gets COVID, one guy is not going to do it. Like, how far do we take this?
Taxi squads, man. Now I'm starting to think about baseball and I'm getting annoyed. It's harder. I don't know the answer to that question. That's crazy. Because in football, the relative value of each position is so different, especially compared to the amount you have on the roster. You know, you only have three quarterbacks, which is the most important, and so that's why you're going to do it. But if you lose all your linebackers, you're going to taxi in a whole new squad? That's not going to work. That's a lot of permutations there. So I feel like I do it for the quarterback, but I don't know if I could extrapolate that out to the whole team because I just don't have that kind of time to do that kind of math.
What about the kicker? You only have one kicker. You might have to put the kicker on it. You might have a designated surviving kicker, too. I don't know.
This is where we go to the kickers who, my favorite type of kicker, the person who handles all kicks, as in you both do the kicking, the kicking off, and the punting. Have two of those guys, and then you're good.
Right. All right. Well, you mentioned baseball. Coming up, we'll give you your daily baseball update. Rob Manfred was just on the MLB Network and said something pretty definitive. We'll share it with you coming up. Clinton Yates in for Mace. I'm John Ireland. Mason in Ireland, 710 ESPN. Mason in Ireland. Clinton Yates in for Mace.
What up?
And Clinton, I don't know. I'll let you help me with this. I don't know if we should tell the audience we are closer to an agreement in baseball, because I don't necessarily think we are, but Rob Manfred was on the MLB Network about half an hour ago, and he said there absolutely will be a season, which means what Jim Bowden said to us the other day is probably very much in play, that if the two sides can't reach a deal, that MLB will exercise their right to just invoke a 49-game season on the players. Where do you think this is all heading?
Well, because some of you may know, I'm a columnist for The Undefeated, and I get out and report every once in a while. I was actually having lunch with an MLB player today, whose name will be withheld until the column comes out on Friday, but I was talking to him about it, and the word he used for a good 40% of the guys that he estimated in just his idle people in the bigs, he said guys were indifferent. And it was a really interesting word to use because I sort of felt like, well, if people are indifferent, and you know, you break down the tiers of the salary structure, you know, league minimum guys are going to play. Guys who have their money, dog, you want to run some sprint race, guys just aren't going to play. And so they can jam a season down our throats, but if there's a noticeable difference in product, Ireland, we've talked about this. I don't think that's good for the game.
Well,
I don't think the worst-case scenario is not playing.
Is the noticeable difference in product just the shortened season, or do you think players would actually sit out?
I think a lot of players would sit out because for two reasons. Number one, the money. Number two, the injury risk scenario is like a twofold thing that is worse than normal. It's not just about whether or not you're going to get COVID coming back out there. It's about if you get hurt once, you're not making it back to the season because of that too. And so why would you put yourself through all that if the likelihood of injury, which is high because they've start and stopped in spring training, and the guys have been training on their own, like, I think for a lot of guys, it's just going to be like, I'm good. You know, and it's as simple as that. It's just not worth the risk when you add all the things up. And as much as people think that baseball has to come back and, you know, it owes it to America and so forth, dude, these guys aren't getting paid what they're owed. They don't owe anything to anybody. It's, in fact, the other way around. So while I think a season might happen, I think we are shooting fast at something that's a product that we might not like, even if we do recognize it. And that, to me, is the worst case scenario, particularly if another wave comes back through later in the fall.
Manfred did this in an interview he did with Carl Ravitch, and they covered a lot of different ground. Here's exactly what he said about what we're talking about. He said, quote, "I would prefer to negotiate a new agreement with the players that gets more games and resolves the issues that have separated us. But at the end of the day, we negotiated for the right in March to start the season on a number of games that we select in these particular circumstances. And if we have to, we'll exercise that right." He also talked about how he doesn't want the season, regular season, to extend beyond September. So it would be harder to jam in. You know, at one point the players were asking for 114 games. They've come off that. The two offers that came out this week, Clinton, were the owners said 76 games with a 75% prorated salary, which means you get 75% of what you thought you were going to get. And the players came back with 89 games, which also included an expanded postseason for the next 2 years. What does it feel like to you as to how many games we might see?
Well, I'll tell you, my overall mood is that it feels like we've already lost a season. If we get a portion of a season, and maybe what I'll just call for the moment a gimmicky playoffs, we'll have something. But for me, it feels like what we understand baseball to be for 2020 is long gone. And not just because of the amount of games played, but just the overall vibe, you know, the way that we're getting back to this, the complete lack of organization on a lot of fronts. I got minor league guys calling me, telling me that their teams haven't talked to them in 3 weeks. You know, never mind not paying them, which they're not doing anymore anyway, and their season ended. But like, this seems to be in disarray. And that, to me, is the more, that's the bigger hurdle to climb, Ireland. You know, it's like, look, you can get people on the same page, but like, are you still going to be able to play the games? Like, do we know that's going to work? And I remind you of this because I happened to be at a ballpark in the major leagues in spring training when they canceled the season. I'm sitting in the daggone media box. We look up at the TV. Oh, commissioner cancels all games. Well, that's weird because I'm sitting right here at a game watching them play, and it's the top of the second. And as a matter of fact, two guys on the field right now had just been hanging out with the president that they said was exposed because of Mar-a-Lago. They're on the field. Okay, those guys come off the field quietly, discreetly, and then they finish the 9-inning game. So, like, again, I don't necessarily trust MLB to get it together from an operational standpoint in order to do this correctly. And I'm not knocking them for that. It's hard. But the labor agreement is one thing. Whether or not they can get the games off is another. It's all a big mess. And if I'm a player and I got enough cash in the bank, or if I'm a free agent, for that matter, I'm looking at it and I'm saying, I'm good. I'm not going to risk COVID for my life, just for my career.
Kind of backing up your point, right before we came on the air, Justin Turner, who's a really smart guy, Justin Turner worked on Wall Street. He has his broker's license. He understands money. The third baseman for the Dodgers. was particularly offended by an interview the Cardinals owner did, a guy named Bill DeWitt. He did a radio interview in St. Louis where he claimed that baseball is not a very lucrative business, that they're not making a lot of money. He said, the exact quote DeWitt used was, "The industry isn't very profitable, to be quite honest." And Turner, blow by blow, it's 10 or 15 tweets, just explains why that's just not true.
Right.
That the Cardinals in particular have been extremely profitable. And he lays it out for you in a way that I would describe as a takedown, as a drop the mic moment. Turner just lays out exactly why the owners trying to sell this baseball's not profitable is a complete lie. And when you read through Turner's tweets, I'm not going to read them all because there's too many of them, but here's the last one. "For crying out loud, be honest. The baseball industry is off the charts profitable. You're a very rich man, and baseball has made you far richer. Claiming anything otherwise is frankly insulting, and I'm being, in your words, quite honest." Turner is, I think, speaking for a lot of players here, Clinton. I don't know if the player you talked to for your piece on Friday was the same way. They just don't trust these owners. And there's a lot of reasons not to trust them. And my sense is that if the owners try and jam a season down their throats, the tweet storm that Turner went on today will be mild in compared to what happens if they do it that way. What do you think?
I agree. And people always say, we talked to Jim Bowden earlier this week, "Oh, the worst thing that could happen is the season not happen." Be careful what you wish for here with this season. If it becomes evident to the average fan that the greed of an MLB owner is taking precedent over A, the development of the game, and B, the current playing of the game, if you get to see where the game is crap, oh, well, then at that point, you've lost the fans and you're the owners that are losing them. This is not a smart move from a PR standpoint to be coming out here trying to snow us with all this stuff. The operative word, the word doing a lot of work, as they say on Twitter, in that situation is "very." The league is not very profitable right now. Well, what is "very" to a billionaire? You know, are you expecting to make God knows the amount of money hand over fist that you can't take losses on? I'm sorry, I thought, you know, revenues were up the last 4 or 5 years. So what is your expectation here, and what is reasonable? What kind of loss should you have to take to save the sport? They are not winning the battle of common sense right now in the court of public opinion. And these kind of things, and I'm not trying to write off what Justin Turner is saying, because it's a tremendous breakdown, but I don't need to have no daggone Series 6 license to be able to look at that and say, well, if the owners are decimating the minor leagues and the owners are trying to pay them 10% more for 50% more work in this last deal, well, they don't care about whether or not baseball comes back. And they might be legitimately, arguably, trying to kill the game. So, you know, I appreciate what he's saying, and because there's a lot of people that will give billionaires trust for reasons I don't understand. And so it's helpful in that regard. But I think we're moving closer and closer, Ireland, to the average baseball fan looking at this and saying, dog, they're the players. Give them money so we can play ball. What are we doing? We're getting there.
Here's exactly what Rob Manfred said to Carl Ravitch about half an hour ago, so you can hear it for yourselves. He was asked, will we have a season? Here's what Manfred said.
I'll be disappointed that we're unable to reach an agreement that allows us to play more games. But you know what? I think at the end of the day, the most important thing, and I'm not buying into your number of 48, the most important thing is that we play Major League Baseball in 2020, and I can tell you unequivocally, we are going to play Major League Baseball this year.
So there you go. He says there is a season coming. We'll see if he lives up to that. Coming up next, Herm Edwards, the head football coach at Arizona State, longtime NFL player, coach, and ESPN analyst, will join us on the program. Clinton Yates in for Mace. I'm John Ireland. Mason and Ireland, ESPN LA. And we roll on. I'm John Ireland. Clinton Yates filling in for Mace. And we're lucky enough to get to talk to Herm Edwards, longtime NFL player, coach, and now the head football coach at Arizona State University. And Clinton, a guy who has a special place in your heart.
Absolutely. For those of you who don't remember, Herm used to be all over the television talking all the time. And when I'd be up in Connecticut, I would see him on a regular basis. So I'd say, Herm, what up? How you doing? Now, my mother had been listening to me on the radio for a long time, and Herm had been coming on our old show. She sees Herm on TV one time. She ain't never said nothing about no guest on any show I'd ever been on. Who's that football coach? I said, I'm sorry, what, Ma? What's his name? Herm Edwards? Yeah, him. I like him. Oh, do you, Ma? Anyway, my mother's favorite football coach is Herm Edwards. Herm, how are you today?
I'm doing well, my friend. Good to hear from you, and tell your mom I said hello, please.
Absolutely. I want to ask you quickly, though. It's been a wild week in America, 2 weeks. You are a brother that is a leader of men. You are at a portion of the game that is in a very different space than a lot of other sports. There is a lot of leadership you have had to be doing in the past 3 months. Where are you right now?
Well, I think we're in a good spot as far as what we're trying to do. When you think about the football side of it, we actually play a sport that social distancing is not good, and we're going to be asked to do that. How we manage our players, how we meet, we haven't even gotten to the practice part of it yet, but our guys are actually going to come in next week as small groups, and, you know, start working out with the weight coaches, which is necessary, obviously, to prepare for the season. But I think every step we take closer to bringing all the team together and how we meet, how we practice, that will be something that's very interesting. And I think we all have to be able to adjust. The number one criteria, I think, in college football and even pro football is the safety of the players, coaches, administrators, anyone that has access to football players, along with the players themselves. So this is a big ask. You know, you're going to have to be very disciplined, not so much when you're in the building, but when you leave the building. Who do you associate with? And, you know, in there lies a little bit of the problem, but we're well aware of that, and we're going to take every step necessary to make sure that we can do this with safety in mind.
Herm Edwards is our guest, and Herm, you've had a long career in the public eye, from a player in the NFL to a head coach in two different cities and now a college coach at ASU. To me, this feels, what we've gone through in the last 3 weeks, feels like a tipping point. I know we've had incidents before of police brutality. I know we've had incidents before of racial injustice. But what we're seeing now are substantive changes and people doing things that I've never seen before. But I'm coming at that as a, you know, with my perspective as a white guy. You are an older African American who's seen a lot more than I have. Does it feel like a tipping point to you?
Yeah, to me, this is if you go back to history, when you read about Rosa Parks, this is a Rosa Parks feeling for me, in the fact that I'll state it this way: Rosa Parks one day got on that bus and just says, "I'm done. I'm not going to the back. I'm tired. America's tired." And it's shown. It's showing. Not only in America, but all over the world. But when you watch the protesters, they're of all different walks of life, different colors, different religion groups. It's the melting pot of America that's under protest right now. And we have a lot of words being said. Now the action of those words has to be delivered. And I think, you know, these young people that are protesting, no different than when they did in the 60s, actually when I was growing up and watched it all unfold. When they protest, you have to realize this. For change to happen, it doesn't happen on a light switch. They're protesting for their kids, when their kids grow up, to make this the America that we dream about, when we hear about and we read about. And where other people come from different foreign lands and countries wanting to make their way in America, given an opportunity to become the betterment of themselves. And so that's what I see. It's very interesting to watch.
A lot of these young people out here, though, are also people on college campuses and people on college football teams. How much of a teaching moment does this become within your program, especially because we've seen how it's, for lack of a better term, divided some others? You know, what do you do from an institutional standpoint as a leader right now with those guys once you get them back?
Well, we've already had a meeting on this, and the AD was on there, as well as myself, and all the coaches, everyone in our organization, and told them this. You have the ability now to speak. I tell them this, make sure when you speak, you have solutions. It's very important. We understand that. And you got to be a good listener as well. And so, you know, this is kind of different for the athletes in today's world. They have a platform, whether it's through social media or regular media, but they have a platform. And they have to be very aware that when they say things, it becomes your resume. It's attached to your name. It's attached to the university's name. And so you have to be very understanding of what you're about to say. Don't put yourself in a position where all of a sudden, 2 days later, you're apologizing, right? Because you said something emotional. But our players are well aware that they have access to say and to speak. You know, and you hear this often. You know, people will say, some fans of sports will say, well, all they should do is catch the ball and tackle people and throw the ball and dribble the ball because they're athletes. Well, no, that's not who they are. That's their occupation. That's not who they are. They're going to be fathers. They're going to be husbands. They're going to be community leaders. And what's amazing to me, when you say something like that, and I look at all these protesters, these people aren't professional protesters. They come from all different walks of life with all different job descriptions. So I think sometimes when an athlete speaks out, we get a little nervous. Well, I don't want them to talk. Well, they can talk, and they're going to talk. Just make sure when you speak, you have some solutions, and also you're willing to listen.
We're talking with Herm Edwards. Herm, it sounds like, you know, one of the most famous speeches you gave is when you were talking to young players. I think they were young NFL players. And you used to say, and everybody kind of attached it to you, you used to say, don't hit send. You know, if you're up late and you're not thinking about what you're doing, you know, don't hit send. Is that still part of your message to kids, or now is it more like what you just said, that, hey, I know you're going to hit send, so just be sure you know what you're doing before you do it?
Well, when I actually said don't press send, what I was actually trying to remind them to, when your fingers start going faster than your brain, sometimes, we all been there. Sometimes we kind of don't look at it. We just press it. And then when it's gone, we look back and go, oh, I should have said that, right? Mm. Or I didn't mean to say it that way, right? But then it's gone. And so that's all I meant by that. I didn't mean you shouldn't press in. It was just a way to get their attention. Don't press in. And I said that day at the symposium, and I haven't figured it out yet. I said, I'm going to get a phone that has the little thing when you're supposed to press, when you press in, it says don't press in. So you have to look at it before you press it. And make you realize, hey, what am I about to say, right? So I just think the platform is open for all those. And I think this is where the voices of you get distracted sometimes. Don't lose your point on what you want to say. And everybody won't agree, by the way, because that's just the way it is.
We're talking with Herm Edwards, who is nice enough to join us here. Herm, last thing for me, and if you'll indulge me for a minute, I'm a UCLA grad,
sure.
And we've had Dick Vermeil on the show many times. I love Coach Vermeil. Just love him.
Yeah.
And I wondered, because you both played for him and coached with him and know him, mm-hmm. What did you take from him more than anything else that maybe you use as a coach? Now, I know when you're a head coach, you take stuff from everybody you've ever been around.
Right.
So it's kind of a collage. But I'm just curious what you took from Dick, if anything.
His passion for the game and his passion for his team. He was very disciplined. There was an order of discipline. There was a standard you had to meet to be a Philadelphia Eagle. Dick Vermeil and my life go way back. He recruited me to UCLA coming out of high school. So I've known Dick since I was 17 years old. And I ended up going to Cal and then playing for him. You know, Dick was important in my life my first year, because my father passed away. And Dick was kind of my security blanket. I needed a guy in my life similar to my dad. And he had a lot of things that he did in life and how he treated people the way my father did. And so I used to mention Dick Vermeil. I mean, I still talk to Dick Vermeil.
As part of the
family? Literally. Oh, man, I'm part of the family. You know, that's the way it is. And anytime I need someone to lean on, I would call him. And you're right. I mean, our careers as a player, and then I coached, and then I got traded when he decided to retire and got traded to the team that he was coaching. And I can remember when he was on TV, they were trying to convince him to come back, and I called him and said, you got to come back, coach. So, I mean, I have a great relationship with Coach O'Neill. There's no doubt about that.
Speaking of family, the Pac-12 family, there's the USC situation with Reggie Bush. I wonder what you think about that. Getting he's back with the back in the fold. It's not exactly an apology from the NCAA, but they're welcoming him back there. What do you think about how that whole thing has played out over the course of his career?
Well, time heals all situations, and I think when we don't get emotional and just sit back and realize it. And I know Reggie, and I think Reggie, like anyone else, when you're young and in college, we're all a little bit, we're not the same person we were 10 years later. We've grown. And no different than for me when I went to college. I'm a different guy as well. And I just think knowing Reggie, where his heart's at, I think it was important for both parties to come back together. He meant too much to college football. He meant too much to that university. So I just think it's time. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I'm happy for Reggie, and I'm happy for the university as well.
Herm Edwards, head football coach at Arizona State University, and my mother's favorite football coach. Thank you for joining us on Mason and Ireland, Herm.
If you tell Mama, stay safe. Okay.
Bruh, I texted her. I said, your boy Herm Edwards is about to be on. She says, oh, okay, that's radio? I was like, yeah. She goes, all right, I'll listen. Which makes me laugh. Thank you, Herm.
All right. God bless
you. Thank you, Herm. Stay safe. All right. Coming up next, Adrian Wojnarowski on SportsCenter has just brought up something that I don't think a lot of people expected in regards to the NBA and the Orlando campus. We'll get into that next. By the way, Marty McGee, who is
It's Ryan McGee.
Oh, why do I
and
say
Marty
McGee?
Smith?
Yeah, that's Marty and McGee. Thank you.
And Ryan McGee is who's coming
Thank
on.
Thank you. Oh, my gosh.
No
I would
problem.
Have done that to him. I'm so glad you did that.
No worries.
Ryan McGee, who is part of Marty and McGee, which is the great show that Clinton's been on and I listen to on the weekends, and a big part of their, they have a Southern flair to their show, and NASCAR.
They're NASCAR. They cover NASCAR. So yeah.
It's always a very big, if not the main part of that show. Ryan will join us in the 5 o'clock hour, and we'll also got Fast Track coming for you. So lots coming up. Clinton in for Mace. I'm John Ireland, Mason and Ireland, 710 ESPN. Mason in Ireland, Clinton Yates in for Mace, as we are rolling on. We've covered a lot of ground today, and something that came up on SportsCenter when we were in our first hour, and Clinton, there isn't or hasn't been a whole lot of talk about, we keep hearing that all these leagues are starting up, that the NBA is going to Orlando. We had the GM of the LAFC on earlier. MLS is opening up today. We college football is all systems go. Pro football looks like it's all systems go. But what if you're a player in one of these sports and you don't want to do it? You just don't feel safe. Adrian Wojnarowski was on SportsCenter talking about the NBA Orlando campus, and he said this.
I think a lot in the last week, 10 days, I think it's really started to hit it home with a lot of players and coaches and members of organizations of how isolating, how restrictive this bubble environment is going to be. And there are a number of players, I was told a few dozen, who have been talking. They had at least one conference call to kind of hash out some thoughts among each other. And listen, for a lot of players, there are family concerns. There are certainly concerns about COVID. There are concerns about a number of issues built around having to go inside that bubble, many of them for 5 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 2.5, 3 months, especially, Kevin, you hear it more and more among the teams who know or certainly believe they're not really going there to compete to win a championship.
So, this is interesting, Clinton. I think there has to be an unwritten rule when we talk about all this stuff, kind of an overlying understanding. Anybody doesn't feel safe, you can't make them go. You can't make people go. Like, even in our line of work, Amanda Brown, who runs our place, said to us weeks, she updates us all the time on when we might be back in the building. And if anybody doesn't want to come back into the building, that you can't make them. You can't make people deal with COVID if they don't want to. What do you think?
Well, the difference there is that you don't come back into the building, you can still do the show.
Right.
I think what Woj is talking about here is that, like, some dudes might be using this as a reason to just check out of the season. Because it will be onerous. I mean, like, let's not get this twisted. I mean, that's the other part of this is people say, oh, you're at Disney. Oh, you're in hotels. Yeah, but like, you're not living your normal life. And when you're a part of a competitive process, that's a big factor. And I'm sure there's a fair amount of guys who just say, I'm not that interested, you know, and if you add up the competitive factor in terms of, you know, what they want to do and don't do, you add the health element, then you add the isolation. I'm sure there's a decent amount of guys who are just kind of trying to get out of it. You know, it's a long haul. And if you can't leave until you, I completely understand this. And while I'm not going to necessarily say that anybody's lying or anybody's blaming anybody else, I totally understand this. I mean, you can tell, but we've talked about this before. Between the guys that are covering this thing, there's a discussion as to whether or not people would want to go. There's a lot of intangibles here, competition-wise aside, that I think are not really coming into play. We discussed the coaches thing before. There are a lot of variables that are going to affect the way this NBA season happens, never mind who goes, in terms of what happens when people get there, that I think will be very interesting. But yeah, Woj makes a good point. I mean, if you've got an out and you don't want to do it, health is a plenty good reason. And even if it's not something you don't want to do, you're just actually afraid. This is reasonable to me. And again, this is where these things become difficult. That's why I don't know why you got to have 8 more games. I mean, I do know why, but that's where these things get tricky, is that if people don't have incentive to do it, in their minds, they're not going to, or they're going to half-ass it, and then that's when people get hurt, and that's not what you want.
Hey, I know I may have asked you this on Monday, but I'm just curious. I'm going to ask everybody. I'll ask Lindsay. I'll ask Funch. Clinton, how confident are you that this NBA Orlando thing goes off the way it's laid out?
Oh, we're in full 50-50 heads or tails. I mean, there's no reason for me to believe more than that. And I guess part of me, the optimist, would like to believe that it's at least half a chance, you know? I mean, because we're not operating with any precedent here. You know, there's no case law in this situation. We don't know. You know, we don't know how Disney's going to deal with the pandemic. We don't even know how the NBA is going to deal with the organization. Half the people who are going to cover the thing, as I mentioned before, don't even know what it's going to look like. There's a lot up in the air. And I don't think anybody should be blamed for any of that, as I said before. But I'm not more than halfway. And I'm only halfway because I'm optimistic. And that's not a problem for me. You know, I want the NBA back. Clearly, the Lakers in particular have business to handle. And there's some playoff matchups that I kind of want to see. Look, I'm a Wizards fan, and I don't think the Wizards should be there. You know, so there's a lot of different...
There are too many games behind.
Right, they're too many games behind. They're not good. They don't need to make the playoffs anyway. It's a long story. But, like, I am not more than halfway of the belief that this is going to happen from a logistics standpoint. But, you know, that's about where I'm at.
Lindsay, are you more confident than Clinton or less that he thinks 50% chance it goes off the way it's laid out?
I think it's more like 70%, because I think that the NBA has put a crazy amount of protocols in place. And I know that manual, that health and safety manual, is supposed to come out today. But it seems to me like the NBA, you know, being a billion-dollar business and industry and with everything going on, I don't think that they would be putting all of this effort into finishing this season if they didn't think there was a pretty good chance that it could happen the way that they want it to. I think it's been well-researched.
I'm with Clint. I think it's 50-50, but I kind of do foresee, like, a top 10, possibly a top 5 player getting COVID during the playoffs and,
right,
like, you know, putting an end to their playoff chances, their team's playoff chances.
I'm actually with Lindsay on this, and I'm a little north of her. I was going to say 75. I think for all the reasons Lindsay laid out, I just think they've asked so many questions, and they took their time. Now, having said that, a 25% chance of it not going right is a pretty, you know, a 250 hitter up in a clutch situation.
You could get a pop.
It's a little scary. Yeah, you hit a ground ball up the middle. So I'm a glass half full guy normally, so I'm thinking 75% chance it goes off. My numbers may be a little high. Yours may be a little more realistic, but I'll tell you this, I'm rooting for it. I think it would be a big boost of morale, and I think it would make a lot of people happy.
I agree.
And a lot of people happy. Okay. Coming up, two things happened today that I didn't think would ever happen in sports. And I keep saying that. I'm saying it almost every day as culture and life intersects with the world of sports. Two things happened today that I didn't see coming and that I would have told you a week ago were never going to happen. We'll get into that. We got Fast Track coming up. Ryan McGee's going to join us. Big last hour next. Mason in Ireland. Clinton Yates in for Mace. 710 ESPN.